The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on Amazon Podcasts. We are on Stitcher. We're on iTunes, all under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. We are on Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. My website is Marie Stone, two R's in Marie. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Drop us a line if you're so inclined. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. I love mornings when we get to welcome back past guests and friends of the show, longtime listeners and attendees of Barbara's speaker series, as well as readers of Orange Coast Magazine. We'll know our guest this morning very well. He was the editor-in-chief for many years. Martin Smith is a veteran journalist and former senior editor of the Los Angeles Times Magazine. He's the author of 5 crime novels and 4 previous nonfiction books. He has won more than 50 magazine and newspaper writing awards. And his novels have been nominated for 3 of the publishing industry's most prestigious honors, including the Edgar Award, the Anthony Award, and the Barry Award. Marty has been on the show 3 times with Barbara. Those past shows can be found in our archives. I think he was twice a guest at the Pen on Fire Speaker Salon with The Wild Duck Chase and Mr. Las Vegas Has a Bad Knee. Today, we are talking about going to Trinidad, a doctor, a Colorado town, and stories from an unlikely gender crossroads. It is published by Bower House Books, and it is going to drive a lot of our discussion this morning and give us a ton to talk about. Marty, welcome back.
Hey, thank you very much.
So I have been waiting for this book for years. I remember you doing a Kickstarter campaign for this some years back, and I so believed in the need for this project that I think it's the only time I've ever actually donated to a Kickstarter campaign.
I was going to say, you were one of the few donors, so thank you so much for that.
So you can imagine how happy I was when I saw the book was entering the world. I just think this is such an important conversation, and it's growing increasingly important as time goes on. So thanks for writing it. I'll just let you set the stage a little and talk about your original inspiration for the book and kind of take us a little into Trinidad. That'll set the tone for the million questions that I have for you.
Well, since we have an hour to talk here, I'm gonna give you the long version of how this book came to be. And the story goes back into the early 1990s. My family, every year, I have a very large extended family, and about every 2 years we have a reunion, and about 80 of us show up somewhere. And in 1991, 92, I can't remember which year it was, we chose to gather in Estes Park, Colorado, which is on the eastern slope, as opposed to where I live now, which is on the western slope. But we were in a large family reunion lodge called the YMCA of the Rockies. So all sleeping under one roof. And that happens to have been the reunion where my cousin decided to transition or publicly announce her transition to the family from male, living as a male, to living as a female. And she did it in a fairly remarkable way. Every morning we'd gather for breakfast. And the first morning she came down, and she was wearing a simple post earring in one ear, you know, which is not particularly radical or feminine. But the second morning, she came wearing 2 post earrings, 1 in each ear. By the 4th breakfast, she was wearing very feminine earrings, which a lot of whispers, a lot of questions among the family. And that was really my first exposure to someone publicly transitioning. And you know how writers are, we sort of tend to file things away in lock boxes in our brains. And I thought, well, that was really interesting. And I don't understand it, but that was really fascinating, particularly watching family reactions to it. There were positive and negative reactions to it. And I just realized I'd sort of witnessed something that I didn't understand. And if you flash forward 10 years to another reunion, this one was in Virginia. And by that time, my cousin was living full-time as a woman and had been doing so for 10 years at that point. And I asked her, I said, naively, I just assumed that anybody who transitions gets surgery. Well, that's not true, but I asked her and I said, so are you getting the surgery or what are your plans? And she said, I don't think so. You know, I like having a penis. And at that point, my head just sort of exploded. You know, I realized that there was so little I understood about gender at that point that I sort of put those questions into my little head lockbox and let them sit there. And now flash forward one more time to 2016, when we moved from Southern California to Colorado after I left Orange Coast Magazine. I started hearing stories about this little remote mining town in Southern Colorado, right on the New Mexico border. It's called Trinidad. And everybody kept saying, oh, you know the story of Trinidad, you know its history, right? And I didn't. Everybody in Colorado knows this part of its history, but very few people outside of Colorado knew it. And that was that from 1969 until 2010, for 41 years, this little remote former mining town was known as what the New York Times once indelicately called the sex change capital of the world. There was a surgeon there named Stanley Biber, who in 1969 had started specializing in this particular brand of gender confirmation surgery. And word got around. And this was at a time when a lot of the big university-based gender clinics were shutting down or pulling back. Johns Hopkins, for example, ended its program in 1979. As those bigger programs shut down, Stanley Biber was the guy left standing, to the point where going to Trinidad became a euphemism for having the surgery. And that's how Trinidad became known as the sex change capital of the world. And I was fascinated by that. And going back to my cousin's experience, I thought, you know, maybe this story, which is involves real people in a real place, during a real period of time, it's not an abstract look at gender theory. It's a real story. And maybe that's a very accessible way for people like me who grew up in a gender binary world and have all these questions in our heads about gender. Maybe that's a way to talk about those issues. And that's how I ended up pursuing this as a book. I thought, here's an opportunity to tell the story, you know, with all these interesting characters in an interesting place and see where it leads.
Remind me again how old your cousin was when she came out.
Let's see, this would have been in the early 90s, and she's about 2 years older than I am. So this if that puts it in perspective.
The reason, well, there's so many reasons this is becoming so important, but as you point out in the book, I think it was Caitlyn Jenner coming out 2016, did you say? 2015?
2015, yes.
Yeah. And it just started to feel like suddenly and very suddenly there was a movement upon us. And I think a lot of the people around, at least around me in my generation, I'm 50. Most of my friends are 60s, this misunderstanding of what's happening. I think people feel very confused and very, I don't know if threatened is the word, but that seems to be the word, that a lot of people that I know who are incredibly open-minded, incredibly liberal, incredibly accepting of the LGBTQ community, this is making them nervous. And so I think that's why this book is so important, to understand this isn't a phenomenon of the last 5 or 6 years. This is a phenomenon of probably the history of man and womankind, but certainly surgery and hormone therapy are making this much more accessible. But I loved this introduction that this has been going on throughout the 20th century. Our eyes are maybe just now becoming open to it.
Sure. I mean, look at the Old Testament. There are a lot of eunuchs in the Old Testament, and there were reasons that eunuchs were valued as members of society. And the science on this has pretty much been settled since the 1930s. There was a researcher in Germany who pretty well defined the development of gender and understood it pretty well since then. Back in the 60s, there was a GI from the Bronx who went to Scandinavia to have the surgery and came back and Christine Jorgensen became a media sensation back in the 50s and 60s. So Caitlyn Jenner's big reveal in 2015 was not certainly the first time, but it is referred to these days as sort of the big bang of awareness because it was so public. You know, the cover of Vanity Fair, you know, an episodic television show discussing her sort of post-transition life. People did become aware of it, you know, and let's face it, there was stature in her life long before her transition. You know, she was an Olympic decathlon champion when she competed as Bruce Jenner. It was a high profile transition that got the conversation going. But, you know, in short order, you look around and Laverne Cox is starring in, you know, Orange is the New Black, and Transparent becomes a hit television show. And it became very much a part of the daily conversation. But I think you're exactly right. I think most people are still pretty mystified by what this means, including many people in the LGBT community. The transgender population is widely misunderstood and unfortunately widely demonized by fearmongers who don't understand it.
And I think that was kind of about the time that transgender restrooms became somewhat ubiquitous. I mean, it depends on where you are. If you're on a college campus, they're very ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed as though I think people felt like this is coming to my personal life, that I have to grapple with these things for myself. I have to kind of make changes to my own way that I conceptualize my own gender. I feel like people were more threatened by this. And so the importance of this book for me is really demystifying, as you say, a lot of these misconceptions that people have. One of which is gender and sex are so very different from each other. Obviously, there's a conversation between the two, but by and large, your gender, as you put in the book, who you go to bed with and who you go to bed as are very different ways to talk about the coin. So I thought maybe we could start there with sort of demystifying and laying to rest some of these common misconceptions that people have. The first one you brought up is that your cousin was not going to go through a gender reassignment surgery. And I don't know how common it is for someone to identify as transgender and choose to not have this surgery, how those percentages break down of that decision.
Well, there are, I don't have an exact percentage for you on that, but there are a number of factors involved. One is cost. Until recently, some insurance companies now are starting to at least consider paying the cost of those medical procedures. But they're very expensive procedures, and not everybody can afford it. And so I know there's a real consciousness of de-emphasizing the importance of surgery in transition. You know, there are many factors. There are the social cues that you can use to, as my cousin did, you know, earrings, you know, the way you dress, the way you present yourself to the world. That's part of gender as well. That's the way you communicate your gender to the rest of the world. And there are, you know, there are hormone therapies. There are, and then there's surgery. There's some combination of all of those things for people who decide to transition. And so I do think it's important. And this was difficult because I'm writing a book about a surgical capital, correct? It's hard to de-emphasize surgery as part of that process. But I think that's the right thing to do because not all people want to go that route. The other is it's a very, very difficult, painful surgery. You know, it's radical surgery, and it inflicts quite a trauma on your body, and the recovery time is long and often difficult. Which is, you know, the challenges of that surgery to me just completely undercut all these absurd arguments that people make. Well, these are just men in dresses trying to get into girls' bathrooms. You know,
yeah,
nobody does that. Nobody goes through what transgender men and women go through when they opt for surgery in order to win a trophy at a, you know, an 800 meter race. I mean, that's absurd. And one of my goals in writing the book, the way I wrote it, was to humanize those stories, to make it very clear that, you know, make it impossible to caricature transgender men and women as having these sort of nefarious or suspect motives. You know, what they go through by the time they arrive at a surgeon's office for those who opt for that is extraordinarily traumatic. And nobody puts themselves through that for anything less than a desperate need for relief.
Correct. That really came through in the book of just how psychologically tortured the subjects you covered are, but I'm sure that's also ubiquitous, I would imagine. One of the things that was interesting to me is I saw that about 1.4 million people in the US identify as transgender. And that number is similar whether you're between the ages of 18 and 24 or whether you're over the age of 65. That number is pretty constant.
Yeah.
in contrast to the LGBTQ community, where that number is rising, and it's rising so much faster in the Gen Z generation than it is in people over the age of 65. So it was interesting to me that as LGBTQ issues are more accepted, talked about kind of in the mainstream, that number is growing, people are more accepting. In the transgender community, it's pretty much a constant. And I don't know if that number would change as time goes on and that community is more accepted and understood and embraced, or if that will remain a constant for the issues that you say, that nobody would choose to live like this if they absolutely had any other choice.
I think you're right. I do think it's going to become easier. I mean, it's already becoming easier to be gender fluid in our culture. And I do think that encourages people to live a little bit more openly. And I suspect that number will rise in the coming years. And I, you know, I think that's a sign of a healthy transition in our culture. If people can set aside their flawed assumptions and their prejudices, as I did, you know, in the process of writing this book, I kind of recognized how ignorant I was about gender issues and how gender develops and how it presents and the sort of biological aspects of, you know, of intersex men and women. I came a long way. You know, I didn't go into this project with any sort of agenda, trying to prove or disprove anything. I just simply wanted to tell these stories. But along the way, you know, I learned just how little I knew about this stuff. And that was surprising to me, because I thought I was a fairly worldly, smart guy. But I hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about gender. The research that I did brought a level of awareness that I'm really glad I have. And I'm hoping that readers who read the book Going to Trinidad will also learn along with me, if that makes sense.
Well, that was my experience in reading it. I mean, I also thought of myself as very open-minded. I have a handful of transgender friends. And so I thought, certainly not what can I learn? I knew I had a lot to learn, but it was illuminating how much I learned and how much I thought about my own gender and just gender relationships in general in ways that I hadn't thought of before. And I would really encourage people, if you don't read the whole book, turn immediately to chapter 7 and the back half of chapter 8 to just educate yourself about biology. That was illuminating to me. I mean, if stories aside, there's just science, and it's important to understand. And I think it's important to demystify so that at least if you have biases and prejudices, you understand at least where you're coming from scientifically.
I'm glad you pointed out that particular chapter. It's called Gender, Genitalia, and Sexuality. I needed that chapter for myself to sort of put it all in one place to understand how those things are three different things. They're interrelated, but they're not inextricably connected. You know, for example, you know, when we're born, you know, our gender is determined by an outsider who takes a quick glance between our legs and decides whether we're male or female. That's a function of biology. We all start off with the same essential substructure for our genitalia. And when you sprinkle it with estrogen, it develops a certain way. It's the same tissues, it just develops a certain way. And if you sprinkle it with testosterone, it develops another way. And that's just a function of biology. But it's a kind of a blunt instrument to determine what your gender is, because your gender is a function of your brain and your self-perception. It's an indicator of gender. And in most cases, your biological body aligns with your brain, but not in all. And that's where gender dysphoria comes in, where it, you know, there's a disconnect between your mind and your body. And, you know, the assumption I think most of us make is that if you've got male genitalia, then you're a male. And that's just not correct. And then, you know, the corollary here is the sexuality part of it. You know, there's, you know, if you're attracted to men when you have male genitalia, you can have the surgery, but you're probably still going to be attracted to men. You know, that's who you are. And, you know, sexuality is again, operates on a completely different, you know, plateau than gender and genitalia sometimes.
It was heartbreaking. There was a section in here where one of your subjects went through, I think it was DNA testing, to find out if there was something about her DNA that indicated she had always been female. I think it was DNA.
Yes.
And it came back that, nope, you're 100% male. You're consistently nothing biologically would indicate that you are biologically a woman. And to your point, it was gender dysphoria. It was the mind-body disconnection. And God, the layers of what these women, men and women, had to endure, from their passports not being acknowledged as the gender they felt, to the, as you say, these surgeries are incredibly brutal, to, you know, their personal relationships, to their relationships with substance abuse, to their relationships with religion. There is no aspect of their life that could remain untouched by these gender issues.
And the incident, the scene that you described, there are two main characters who are patients in the book that I tell their stories in parallel. One of them is Claudine Griggs, who I used to embody the vast, vast majority of transgender men and women who go through the surgery and, you know, are absolutely convinced, as difficult as it was, that this was the right thing for them to do. There's a figure that's often used, you know, about 95 to 97% of people who go through it are convinced that it was the correct thing to do and would do it again if they were in the same situation. After she had her surgery, she had these questions, and she made an appointment at UCI to have her chromosomes analyzed and see if there was anything in her genetic makeup that made her transgender. Of course, there wasn't. You know, your genetics are your genetics. You know, if you're born XY, you're going to be XY. If you're born XX, you're going to be XX. That doesn't change, even if you have surgery, even if you go through hormone treatments. But the question that she was pursuing was one that is so central to human identity. And it is, you know, who am I and how did I get to be who I am? And she was hoping her genetics would give her an answer to that. And it didn't. You know, it told her who she was genetically, but that really didn't have much to do with who she was, you know, in real life. And the other mention you brought up, you said, you know, trying to explain your gender to someone in a passport office or, getting a driver's license, which is something that many transgender men and women have to do. And try to imagine the indignity of standing there trying to explain to someone at the DMV that, yes, my birth certificate may say that I was born a male, but in fact, I'm a female. Those are moments. And there was the other main character, patient character in the book is a gentleman named Walt Heyer, who tells the story of coming to tears in a Bay Area DMV office because he was trying to convince somebody that he was who he was and couldn't. And just the indignities of that. I think, when you look at what's happening now, where there's all this fear mongering going on, you know, should transgender men and women be allowed to compete in the sport of their, you know, with their appropriate gender? You know, should they be allowed to use public restrooms? You know, the indignities, why would we want to heap additional indignities on these men and women whose lives have already been challenging? I don't understand that.
Well, to your point, there was a court case last week you probably saw out of Ohio where a federal appellate court ruled with a professor who refused to use his student's preferred pronoun. They sided with the professor to not use it. And I thought, how could you not extend somebody that level of dignity to honor their request? But yeah. That's a longer subject for a different time. But talk a little bit about finding these patients, finding Claudia and finding Walt, and how you got introduced to them and how they kind of opened themselves up to you.
You know, I started thinking, oh, this is going to be great. You know, there were 6,000 medical pilgrims who came to Trinidad during that 41-year period between 1969 and 2010. And many of them are still out there, and I can just go interview them and talk to them about their experiences. And it turned out to be not quite that simple. One of the first things I learned about transgender men and women is that they're perfectly comfortable talking about their lives since transition, but their lives before transition is like revisiting a traumatic event in some cases. Their lives were difficult. They were socially ostracized. They were in physical and emotional pain. To ask them to tell me that story with its full arc, beginning, middle, and end, proved to be incredibly difficult. Not many people want to revisit that period of their lives. And so those 6,000 possibilities quickly winnowed down to a few that I knew would be willing and sort of fit my criteria. One was, had they left behind a contemporaneous record of their experience in Trinidad? I found two people who had. One was Claudine Griggs, who had written a book not too long after her transition called Journal of a Sex Change, Passage Through Trinidad, in which she, and she's an extraordinary writer and a remarkable thinker. And she was so honest in her retelling of her own story. You know, here I was presented with this treasure trove of a, you know, step-by-step, moment-by-moment passage through Trinidad. Plus, she's still alive and very vital. And I could call her up and I could go visit her. At the time, she was running the writing center at Rhode Island College in Providence, Rhode Island. So I could go and spend time with her and listen to her stories and get her to elaborate on things she had written about in the book. So that was a huge criteria for me, is finding someone who was comfortable talking about it and had kept a really good record of it. The other person who rose to the top was this gentleman named Walt Heyer, who's a very different kind of story and does not in any way represent the experience of the vast majority of men and women who go through surgery. His story is a story of a four-decade struggle with mental illness, none of which had anything to do with gender dysphoria. He was misdiagnosed. But I thought his story was an interesting lesson because it allowed me in the book and it allowed Walt to raise questions that I think most people have. Troubling kind of head-on questions that, you know, what if I do this and I later regret it? And, you know, including him as a parallel character to Claudine in the book, which is turning out to be not a popular decision, but one I think for storytelling reasons was necessary.
I came away with it a little bit more confused. You know, I expected to go into the book thinking, okay, you know, I'm really going to get behind all of these decisions. And I didn't understand how violent the surgery really is. I didn't understand the kind of the nitty gritty of what people have to go through. So to do that, to consent to that, you really have to be committed, I would think. And so reading his story and his regret and his torment for his entire life, I mean, I was impressed at the end that he was still alive. I really had thought that story might end in suicide.
As fortunately, so many of them do.
Right.
Right. You know, that's the other thing that to me gave this a sense of urgency. One is if you look at the percentage of transgender men and women who experience suicidal thoughts or commit suicide, it's 41% of that population compared to 4% of the general population. I mean, it's just an astounding number and gives you some sense of the pain, you know, that they're facing. And the other statistic that I think should disturb us all are the homicide statistics, particularly among transgender men and women of color. It's just, again, why would you, you know, if they're facing those challenges already, to now deny them the dignity of being able to serve in the U.S. military or to get healthcare coverage, it just seems too much. It just seems wrong. I guess that's ultimately where I came down was, you know, there's a difference here between right and wrong. And this is wrong.
It goes to how deep our own insecurity is about our gender, I think. I mean, it really has to be threatening to people for them to be so violent and react so strongly against this, I would imagine, because otherwise, why would you do it? I mean, I think people really feel they must feel threatened or their own masculinity, femininity threatened. I don't know.
People are afraid of what they don't understand. And that, I think, was my, you know, my driving motivation in writing Going to Trinidad is to make it understandable as best I could. And I don't pretend to speak from experience. You know, I have never lived the transgender experience. I'm a journalist. I'm not an expert at anything. And I, you know, I can just tell stories. But I think listening to those stories, again, makes it impossible to reduce them to one dimensional. This is very complicated stuff. And that's what I was hoping, is that if you can tell those complicated stories and bring them down to a very human level, it makes them a little bit more understandable.
My guest this morning is Martin Smith. The book, Going to Trinidad, A Doctor, A Colorado Town, and Stories from an Unlikely Gender Crossroads. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thank you. I haven't followed everything you've written, but I've followed a lot of things you've written. And this struck me, and you can speak better to this than I can, one of the most complicated, fraught, politically, socially, otherwise psychological landmines that you could have been stepping on all the way through writing this. And so I wondered, you know, in your vast experience of journalism and reporting, this felt different than other things you have done. And I wondered if that was your experience from the inside of, you know, if you felt like there were a lot of landmines that you were tiptoeing around and how to be extra sensitive aside from Mr. Las Vegas has a bad knee was fun and wonderful, but it didn't feel fraught in the way this felt fraught.
You know, that's an excellent question. And it did feel different to me. Although I'm a pretty simple-minded guy, I just spotted what I thought was going to be a really good story. One of the things when I'm writing a novel or writing a nonfiction book, I'm looking for the same things. I'm looking for bigger than life characters whose lives can really come alive on the page. I'm looking for high stakes. What are the stakes for those characters? You know, in a case like this, in the case of going to Trinidad, the stakes are life and death. People show up at a surgeon's office as an alternative to committing suicide. I mean, that's an extraordinary level of stakes for these characters. And the other is timeliness. It felt urgent to me for a number of reasons, but mostly because transgender men and women were facing an unprecedented assault on their civil rights here in the last few years. And I didn't see it as a political thing, but it just felt urgent to be able to tell their stories. And it did feel different. And, you know, I didn't approach it with all that in mind. I approached it because I just thought there was a great story here. It had all the great components of a good story. And I went into it with that in mind. I learned very quickly. In fact, that Kickstarter campaign was the first time that this idea sort of had any public exposure of writing this book. I got some immediate pushback, particularly one of mistrust. A, what's your agenda? You know, what point are you trying to prove by writing this book? B, who are you to write this book? You're a cisgender male. What can you possibly bring to the equation that would illuminate this transgender issue? There was some mistrust. And I understand that. You know, there's an ethos out there right now. Nothing about us without us. You know, you can't tell our stories. We're the ones that should tell our stories. I support that. I understand that. But in this case, there was not a long line of people waiting to write a book about Trinidad. I was it. And so, you know, I resolved at that point that it was humbling. I just had to resolve that, look, I need to learn the vocabulary. I need to learn, you know, as much as I can about the science of gender. And I need to be able to approach all of these stories with respect. Every story that I heard, you know, was compelling. And I needed to sort of just listen and learn. And this one did feel different for me because, you know, previous books I've done, the nonfiction books, there's a lot of research involved and a lot of characters involved. It had all the same basic components, but this one had an extra layer of, as you said, it was fraught. There was a bit of a minefield that I stepped into unwittingly. And so I tried to step very cautiously while at the same time telling an honest book, you know, making sure that the book was honest and honorable.
Well, the argument that I would make for you being the right person to write it is that there does need to be a bridge between our generation, the boomers, the Gen Xers, people over the age of even 40, who are heterosexual, cis, men, women, whatever we are, to bridge our brains to understand these issues. And I don't know how many of us would attached to a book about transgenderism written by a transgender person. I'm just saying that you are a very comfortable entree to that discussion where you feel familiar enough. We can identify with you. We'll let you take us by the hand and guide us into this other world where we might not otherwise go.
Well, thank you for that. And that was my hope, is that I could, you know, I could sort of, you know, be that bridge. I take great joy in the fact that my own kids, you know, this is no big deal to them. Gender, yeah, they know lots of gender fluid people. They don't bat an eyelash at it. But I do think, you know, like I said, those of us who grew up in a gender binary world where you were either male or female or a few degrees one side or the other of that was our reality. And, you know, science has known for decades, many decades, that that's really not the case, that gender manifests along a spectrum. Biology manifests along a spectrum. And the more we can understand about that, I think the more tolerant we'll be. At least that was my hope. You know, I was hoping that the book would be a good conversation starter for those issues.
I know that from a journalistic perspective, you would never have your subjects vet or review material. Was that ever part of this where you wanted them to see how they were portrayed and get their sign off, or that never enters your journalistic brain?
Typically, it does not. In this case, it did. And I'll tell you why. I'm dealing with the most intimate details of these people's lives. I wanted to get them right. I wanted to make sure I got them right first and foremost. But I wanted to make sure that I handled it right, as opposed to just getting the facts right. There's an issue of tone. There's an issue of, you know, again, just sensitivity that I wanted to make sure I got it right. And so I wrote the book. But before I finished editing it, I did have Claudine Griggs and Walt Heyer read the book. I also had my cousin, transgender cousin, read the book. I had two or three other trans folks read the book just to make sure I wasn't, you know, doing stupid things, which I fully admit I'm capable of doing. And I wasn't, you know, that I was interpreting these stories correctly and understanding them correctly and honoring them. And so I did. I did let them, you know, not with an idea of you can take that quote out, because I had it all recorded. I mean, there was no denying that they said the things they said, but I wanted to make sure that I had it right, because I knew there were going to be a lot of people that thought, okay, we don't trust this guy to begin with. And look, he got her age wrong. Well, I wanted to make sure I didn't do that, that I got everything right.
So let's talk about Dr. Stanley Biber, who is the surgeon who was performing these surgeries since the 60s, I think, mm-hmm. right? He's a larger than life. Speaking of larger than life characters, he was a total larger than life character. He's been gone since, I think, 2006. So introduce us to him and your discovery of him and what made him so fun to, he was fun to read about. What made him so fun to write about?
You know, he's the absolute heartbeat of Going to Trinidad, the book. It begins with him. You know, this was a guy, you know, he sort of a brilliant young man. I mean, he could have, his career could have taken him in a number of directions. He was in rabbinical school for a while. He was a concert pianist, you know, capable of operating at that level. But he ended up going to medical school, and he ended up becoming a MASH surgeon in Korea during the Korean War. Anyone who's familiar with that, I mean, that is trial by fire for a surgeon. You're dealing with multiple traumatic injuries every hour of every day. It's an assembly line. You're doing the best you can. In Korea, there were a lot of landmines, and he found himself dealing with a lot of lower body trauma, extremities, you know, people who had their reproductive organs damaged by stepping on landmines and that sort of thing. And he found himself doing these very complicated reconstructive surgeries to try and A, save their lives, and B, leave them with some function. And so he got pretty good at that stuff. And when he got out of the army, he ended up taking a job in Trinidad, Colorado. The United Mine Workers were opening a clinic there, and they needed staff and they needed a surgeon. And so he hired on as the surgeon to be the town's only general surgeon working out of this United Mine Workers clinic that serviced the mines there. And he found that he was kind of a cowboy as a child. He imagined himself as a cowboy. And here he was in this place, a ranching community, where he could actually indulge that fantasy. And he became, in the end, he was one of the largest landowners in Los Animas County. He had six or seven non-contiguous ranches where he ran cattle. He would do that. That was his day job before he went in to do surgeries. And try to imagine the circumstances. This is in 1969, when, you know, people didn't talk about these issues. When he first started doing these issues, he's a Jewish doctor operating in a Catholic hospital that's staffed and run by the Sisters of Charity. And starting in 1969, you know, he starts doing gender reassignment or confirmation surgeries. And the way that started was that he often worked with a social worker on cleft palate cases, children in the county who had cleft palates, and he would surgically repair them. And the social worker would bring those patients to his attention. And one day after a meeting, this social worker said to him, "Would you consider doing my surgery?" And he was, you know, he was the ultimate super confident surgeon. And he said, "You know, sure, what do you got? I can do your surgery. What is it?" And she said, "I'm a transsexual." And his response was, "What's that?" He knew about Christine Jorgensen, you know, who had been a media sensation in the 50s and 60s, but he really didn't know much about that particular surgery. But he was enterprising. He tracked down some diagrams from a surgeon at Johns Hopkins and looked them over and said, "Well, yeah, I think I can do this," and did it. And not only successfully did the surgery, but he did it in a way that gave that woman all of the dignity that she deserved. And word started to get around. "Hey, there's this doctor in the middle of nowhere, Trinidad, Colorado. You can go and they're going to treat you like a human being and they're not going to judge you. And they are going to give you a competent surgery that you're seeking and to relieve your pain." And like I said, it wasn't long before going to Trinidad became the euphemism for that. And again, at the center of all that is Stanley Biber, who is, you know, the other career he might have had was as a professional weightlifter. He was a fairly short guy, stocky. But he once claimed that he missed making the Olympic weightlifting team by 20 pounds. You know, he couldn't lift quite enough to get on the Olympic team. But all through his life, he was sort of a bodybuilder, amateur bodybuilder. And just a, you know, like I said, a character with so many interesting layers to him. It was like peeling an onion.
I got the impression that he was leading with not a God complex, but sort of leading with bravado and, as you say, not overconfidence, but a confident surgeon, as opposed to compassionate. "I have such emotion and feeling for these transgender community." It was more like, "I have the skills and chops to do this, and so I'll apply it in this way."
I think that's probably what drew him into it, was that, "I wonder if I could do this, you know?" And yeah. He learned and taught himself how to do it. But I do think compassion quickly took over as he got to know his patients and got to know and understand the level of pain with which they arrived at his office. And it was interesting in the early days, again, remember, Jewish surgeon in a Catholic hospital in a fairly conservative, mostly Hispanic Catholic town, word started to get around that he was doing these unusual surgeries. And he was lying at first. He was saying, "Oh, these were accident victims. I just simply needed to do some reconstructive surgery." But he realized as word was getting around that he wasn't going to be able to maintain that for very long. And so he did a very smart thing. He said it was one of the smartest things he ever did. And that was convene a meeting of hospital administrators, local clergy, local politicians, got them all in a room. And he said, "Look, word's going around that this is what I'm doing. And yes, it is what I'm doing. Here's why I'm doing it. I have the skills to help these people. They need help." And because he was Stanley Biber, because he delivered everybody's baby in town, because he stitched up everybody's stab wound, because he repaired their hemorrhoids in his office, you know, he was the general surgeon. Everybody knew him. Everybody trusted him. And when Stanley Biber said, "This is okay," they just sort of said, "Okay, if Stanley says it's all right, it's all right." And they accepted that. And that was, again, that was in the early 1970s. And what followed were decades of people being very accepting and very tolerant of the 3 to 4 transgender patients a week who were coming to Trinidad, not just by themselves, but with their spouses, with their lovers, with their family members. They were eating in the restaurant. They were staying in the hotels. They were out there on the sidewalk. Everybody sort of accepted that as part of the town's makeup because Stanley said it was okay. And I think that's remarkable. I really think that says wonderful things about the city of Trinidad and Stanley Biber himself.
I also love that he was a cheapskate. My favorite story is that he took his wife to a drugstore and had her pick out a Valentine's Day card, which she read, and then he said, "Just put it back," whatever.
He was notorious. I mean, that's the first aspect of his personality. You know, among all the wonderful aspects of his personality, the cheapness is what people tell the most stories about. I talked to his longtime financial advisor, a guy who had been his advisor for many years. And he said, "You know, I remember you know, I had a lunch meeting with him, and he shows up in this pickup truck that, you swear, it was like the kind of pickup truck that the terrorists drive in the Middle East, you know, that have machine guns mounted on them. It was this old beat Toyota pickup truck. That was his daily driver. I mean, that's what he did business in, because he was a rancher. And he said there was absolutely no pretense about the guy. And he would spend money, but only for land and cattle. Everything else, he didn't dress, you know, he didn't dress well. He didn't, you know, he didn't have fancy houses. He wanted land and cattle.
So you've got all these mounds of, you've got, I assume, reams of interviews. You've got all of the material on Stanley, all the interviews that you did about him, background on Trinidad. I don't know what your office looks like, but as you're putting this book together, what does your office look like? How do you structure all of this into sort of cohesive story that, you know, you've got the human interest part of this, you've got the medical science part of this, you've got the social, sociological, psychological part of this. Tell me a little bit about taking all of that stuff and putting it together and knowing how to structure it.
You know, it's funny. This is my 10th book, you know, 5 novels, and this is my 5th nonfiction book. 2 of those 10 books have felt like I hit the sweet spot. You know, if you've ever played basketball or golf, and sometimes when you hit the ball, it just goes. It's magical. And you don't know how you could do it. You don't know how you could ever do it again, but you know, it just, this was one of those books. This and Wild Duck Chased, from that was published in 2012. They both felt like they wrote themselves in terms of structure, in terms of, you know, research, in terms of just the storytelling aspect of it. I think because the stories were so just naturally interesting to me, the structures of both of those books, this one in particular, just kind of presented itself as an entire, you know, whole, fully born vision from the very start. And it, you know, I just had to, I often compare it to sort of, you know, a train leaving the station, and I was just running to catch up with it. I've often thought that journalists get in the way of telling the stories that they're supposed to be telling, and the best thing they can do is just get out of the way and let it tell itself. And that was the case with this. In terms of what my office looks like, on any given day, it looks like it's been hit by a tornado. So, you know, I think that's just kind of endemic to the writing trade.
Tell me the story about finding the publisher, because this is a new publishing house for you. You alluded to the fact that people were a little bit wary about A, the story, the content of the story, and B, who was telling the story. So tell me a little bit about finding this publisher and knowing that they were the right choice.
You know, this, we started shopping this book shortly after there had been a controversy in New York publishing. I'm blanking on the name of the book, and I apologize. But it was a woman who had written a book about an immigrant experience.
Oh, American Dirt.
American Dirt. That's it. It had just come out, and it had just kind of exploded and blown up because of the question of, does this writer have the right to tell this story? This writer was not, you know, I believe she was, it's a story of a Hispanic immigrant. She had sort of massaged her resume a little bit to sort of emphasize, I think she had some Puerto Rican background or something. I can't remember the details, but it had blown up and she had been demonized. And there was a great discussion going on at the time we started shopping, going to Trinidad, about who has the right to tell these stories. And this fell directly into that chasm. A number of major New York publishing houses expressed enthusiasm for the book. They were fascinated by the idea that there was this little town in Colorado that was a gender crossroads for 4 decades. But they always found a reason to sort of say, but I just don't think we're the right house for this, or, you know, whatever. And I hold no animosity toward them. I mean, there are many reasons that go into publishing houses making these decisions. And I don't presume to know what those were. But I knew that we went through a lot of publishers with a really good idea that nobody picked up on. We ultimately did get one offer from an East Coast publisher, but we also got an offer from this publishing house named Bauer House in Denver, Colorado, a very Colorado publisher, very organic to this particular story. I had met the publishers just in a social setting, and they seemed interested in the book and ultimately made an offer on the book. And they, you know, made a small, modest offer on the book, but I liked them and I knew they produced beautiful books. And I thought, yeah, let me do this. I've been with a lot of major publishers. I wanted to go with a smaller publisher because I wanted this book to be the sole focus of their attention, or not the sole focus, but I wanted it to be a big deal for them. And I wanted that experience. And it's funny, you know, the minute that sold as a print book and it comes out in hardcover on April 15th, the minute the print rights sold, well, the floodgates opened. You know, my agent began shopping the audio rights for it. The audio rights for the book ended up in a four-way auction that went for four or five rounds. And God bless them all. It brought in far more money than the print version did. And we now have a TV film offer. So I think it was a matter of one courageous publisher, Bauer House in Denver, taking a risk and saying, we believe in this book and we will publish this book. Once that happened, I think it was okay for people to say, all right, well, maybe this is okay.
You have the film rights out for the book?
We do. We have a pending offer, but I can't really talk about it. It's still in negotiation. And I've been around long enough to know that sometimes those work out and sometimes, most times they don't. So I make no presumptions, but the fact that there's interest is very encouraging to me.
Well, the reason I asked that question is because when I was reading the book, I was wondering if there was any discussion of including photographs. And I ran to my own computer. Marcy Bowers and I assume she has no relation to Bauer House. So Marcy Bowers took over Stanley Biber's practice. And so I looked her up and I had this internal debate about whether photography would be helpful or sensationalistic or gawky or something else. And I haven't resolved that in my own head, but I did look her up and then it did lead me to think it would be interesting to have photography. And then as you were saying, you know, that the film rights might sell, that's also very interesting, and getting people on board to participate in that would be its own challenge. But the visual aspect is interesting to me.
It is. And we did discuss using pictures and and the fact is I had been unable to locate the kind of quality photographs that I thought would elevate the book. I didn't want it to be just, here's a screen grab that we got from somewhere, or photograph that doesn't really convey the dignity that I hoped. And so I think ultimately the publisher decided, no, let's not. You know, there was an excerpt published in a Denver magazine recently that did include photography. And, it will probably be a revelation to a lot of people to see what Claudine Griggs looks like and Marcy Bowers. And I should, we haven't really talked much about Marcy Bowers, but I should mention, she, as Stanley Biber got older, he knew that he had a practice and a legacy that he wanted to continue. And he, over the years, auditioned a lot of surgeons to come to Trinidad and see what he did, learn from him, and maybe take over the practice. And it ultimately, Marcy Bowers, who was a very well-established, very well-respected OBGYN in Seattle, ultimately did make the decision to come to Trinidad and take over the practice, which she did in 2003. She started transitioning into that role. And when he died in 2006, she took it over entirely. But she herself is transgender and brings that, dimension to her work. And ultimately, she stayed there until 2010 and then moved her practice to Burlingame, California. I think she encountered some tension there because A, she was an outsider, B, she was transgender herself. And, it was nobody's fault, but I think that she just felt that she would be better off moving, out of that area and reestablishing herself somewhere else. Again, I don't think there were no bad actors in that. Everybody was operating in good faith, but she wasn't Stanley Biber, and the town didn't quite embrace her the way that they had embraced Stanley Biber.
We're drawing down on our time, which is killing me because there's so much to talk about. But is there writing advice you can leave us that you haven't left us with in the past? Maybe something that this project revealed to you, or advice that sustained you along the way as journalist, nonfiction writer?
I go back to something I brought up a minute ago. The more you do this, and I've been doing journalism for 45 years now, the more you do it, the more confident you get that your interpretation of the story is the best one. That's not always the case. And again, in this case, I think the best advice I gave myself and I would give other people, is to just get out of the way. Let the subjects of the story tell the story. You know, you can impose your point of view on it. You can impose your voice on it by the way you structure that story, by the way you characterize your characters. You know, you're going to come through, but it's best to let them tell their stories in as pure a way as you can. And I think that's what I tried to do with going to Trinidad. And it took me back to the journalism 101. You don't matter. The people you're writing about matter. And that's what's important.
Could you feel points in either your interview process or the writing process where you could feel yourself getting in the way? Were there times that you, or sensations that you had that were telling you get out of here, get out of the room, get out of the way, or I'm about to make a judgment that maybe I shouldn't make? Like, are there things that writers can listen to inside themselves to warn themselves when that's happening?
I think there's a honed instinct, but it's an instinct nonetheless. You know, a gut feeling that this doesn't belong here. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you a specific example. When I was at Orange Coast Magazine, I had worked on a story with a writer named Caitlin Rother. She's a true crime writer in San Diego, about a notorious murder case in Orange County, where in prison, the perpetrator of this crime was on death row and was transitioning from male to female. And the story we ended up writing was about public tax dollars could be used to help this person, you know, get this surgery. And they're on death row and they've done this horrible thing. And, you know, what are the ethics involved there? And I mean, it was a fascinating story. But I included that because it was the very first time I ever heard the word Trinidad, Colorado. The words Trinidad, Colorado, because it turns out that part of the motive for the crime was this person was trying to pay for their surgery. And I thought, oh, that's a great story. I'm going to tell that story. But, you know, when I put it in the book, it was in an initial draft of the book. I thought, you know what, this story is so powerful. And the crime was so horrendous. It casts a shadow that shouldn't be in this book. And I realized I was kind of telling that story because it was about me. It was the first time I ever heard of Trinidad, and it really didn't matter. And we ended up taking it out. And I think that was a good call. I just think it didn't belong in the book for the reasons that, A, it had nothing to do with the story of Trinidad. It was just about me. And B, it cast a shadow on the lives of transgender men and women because that crime was so horrible that it really just didn't belong in the book. I was afraid it would color it in a way that I just thought would be unfair.
And I had totally forgotten about that story, but yeah, you're reminding me. Well, go read that as well, separate and apart from going to Trinidad. It's also just a compelling, compelling reporting. Marty Smith, this was so fun. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, I'm so grateful for the time.
So we can find you. You have a great website. I assume you're going to be doing some events for this book. And I also wanted to just give a shout out to, I think you do some writing workshops and whatnot from your home in Colorado. So if writers are interested in that, your website contains all of that as well. So I really encourage people to check out your website for a lot of reasons.
Thank you, Marie. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Enjoyed the conversation.
That was Martin J. Smith. The book is Going to Trinidad, A Doctor, A Colorado Town, and Stories from an Unlikely Gender Crossroads. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.